Hi, I'm Renika. I'm finishing my internship with The World. For the past 7 months, I've been working closely with the digital team to bring you the stories you love from the radio to our website and social media. The World is special because we bring you important issues from across the globe, told through human voices. With misinformation on the rise, funding for public media to tell stories on the ground is more important than ever. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Your support means the world to our newsroom. Thank you. And now, the show.
Hey there. I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. Three European countries say they're recognizing a Palestinian state. It's a symbolic move and can also be seen as an expression of frustration aimed at Washington.
Look, we can't sit around and wait for Israel to agree to a Palestinian state when they openly say it will never happen. So something has to give.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. In France, the public mourns the loss of a writer who was known for his empathy.
It was not about himself. It was about the people he was talking to. He was like a sponge.
And in Kazakhstan, a low-tech way of saving a lake in danger of disappearing. It could be used elsewhere.
I mean, it's a backhoe and some rocks to seal off this hole in the causeway. It's super cheap engineering.
Those stories and more coming up on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We're glad to have you with us on this Wednesday. Spain, Ireland, and Norway said today they will officially recognize a Palestinian state next week. Parliamentarians in Madrid applauded Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez's announcement.
España aprobará en su Consejo de Ministros el reconocimiento al Estado de Palestina.
Ireland's Prime Minister Simon Harris declared this a landmark day for Palestine.
We believe in freedom and justice as the fundamental principles of international law, and because we believe that permanent peace can only be secured upon the basis of the free will of a free people.
Israel condemned today's announcement, calling it the equivalent of awarding a gold medal to Hamas terrorists. Israel recalled its ambassadors to all three nations, and the finance minister said he would withhold tax revenues for the Palestinian Authority. For more on the implications of this decision, we reached out to Khaled El-Gindi. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute.
It's mostly symbolic, but I think it does have some meaning and some impact. But it's also a way for countries to do something given the current catastrophe going on in Gaza without really doing all that much. It's relatively low-hanging fruit for the most part, but it's not meaningless.
So it's mostly symbolic, but you said it does have some real-world impact. What is that? What is that impact?
There's a kind of psychological impact that goes into, you know, the fact that this is now a growing circle of nations that recognize Palestine, particularly Western European countries. It's much more significant. You know, countries that have historically, you know, very much aligned with the United States, for them to take this approach, it kind of creates a certain inevitability toward a Palestinian statehood in a psychological sense. But I think it's also a way to register their disapproval with Washington's handling of the Israel-Palestine issue.
You're saying this is in reaction largely to U.S. policy. The U.S. has long said it is working toward the creation of an independent Palestinian state, but that should happen through negotiations with Israel. Why has Washington held so tightly to that position when we're seeing increasingly other countries put that in a different order, those steps?
Yeah, I mean, Washington is, I think most people know, has a very close relationship with Israel. We're seeing that in Gaza over the last nearly 8 months, in which the U.S. pretty much provides almost unconditioned support for Israel militarily, financially, politically, diplomatically, in every way. And that's been true of U.S. Sponsorship of the peace process. It has weighed in when it does weigh in very heavily in Israel's favor, even though Israel is clearly the stronger party. And I think there's a recognition that it's an untenable position, that if Palestinians can't have a state until Israel approves, then Israel essentially has a permanent veto over Palestinian freedom. And so I think this move by a number of European states is a way to reject that and say, look, you know, we can't sit around and wait for Israel to agree to a Palestinian state when they openly say it will never happen.
So I know you've said this is mostly symbolic, but who and what specifically are these three European countries recognizing? Meaning, who belongs to this Palestinian state and where is this state on a map?
Yeah, I think at its core, they're recognizing a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which are the territories that Israel occupied after 1967. Whether or not they delineate exact borders, everyone understands that's the territory of the state of Palestine that we're talking about. And the who would be all the Palestinians who live there in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. So about 5.5 million or so people.
Israel says recognition of a Palestinian state rewards Hamas, which attacked Israel on October 7th, of course, setting off this ongoing war in Gaza. Do the Israelis have a point there?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, first of all, Palestinians have a right to freedom and self-determination. That is inherent. That is not dependent on the actions of one party or another. It's just by virtue of being human beings. There's only two ways Palestinians can exercise their right to self-determination, either in their own state alongside Israel, or as citizens of a broader state with the Israeli Jewish population. Israel has ruled out both of those possibilities and instead is insisting on kind of permanent subjugation of the Palestinian people. So that is what is untenable. So I think the idea that this is rewarding terrorism is a kind of paternalistic, maybe even a colonial mindset in which, you know, Palestinian rights are entirely dependent on the whims of, you know, the great powers and especially Israel.
Is it safe to assume that these announcements will have little impact on the ground with the war in Gaza?
Yeah, and it might even be a bit of a distraction from the extremely dire situation that's unfolding in Gaza, but it will probably be a momentary distraction. People will go back to either focusing on Gaza or watching, which is mostly what the international community has been doing, tragically watching events unfolding there.
Khaled El-Gindi is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, explaining the implications of Spain, Ireland, and Norway announcing today they will recognize a Palestinian state. Meanwhile, in France, a funeral is being held tomorrow for a man who went by the name Fred De Wild. That's actually a pen name. De Wild was a gifted illustrator and writer. The 58-year-old became a household name in France for his illustrated memoirs. They describe living with the trauma of being a survivor of two terrorist attacks: the November 2015 attack at the Bataclan Concert Hall in Paris, and then an attack in Nice the following year. Reporter Rebecca Rossman shares this remembrance.
In his first illustrated memoir, Mon Bataclan, or My Bataclan, Fred De Wild tells the story of how he survived the concert hall attack, lying on the floor and pretending to be dead. In his second memoir, La Morsure, or The Bite, he talks about the pain of living as a survivor. Life, he says, had become like living in an elevator.
One day is really fine, one day is awful. One night is crazy and we don't sleep, one night is absolutely marvelous.
That's De Wild speaking to the world in 2018. When he died by suicide earlier this month, he became the 132nd victim of the November 2015 Paris attacks. When terrorists linked to the Islamic State targeted local bars, restaurants, the National Soccer Stadium, and the Bataclan Concert Hall. For all the survivors, it's a night that can't be erased.
We went to a concert. We had a normal life. And all of a sudden, something came in our life that was hell, then disappeared and left some ruins.
Arthur de Nouveau was also at the Bataclan Concert Hall that night. Today, he's the president of Life for Paris, a support group for survivors of the attacks. De Wild was a regular at their meetings. Deneuveau describes de Wilde, who he says could have been a rugby player because of his big and tall stature, as a gentle giant for everyone at Life for Paris.
He would hug you, he would take care of you, and he would always ask questions. You know, it was not about himself, it was about the people he was talking to. He was like a sponge, trying to get, you know, everything he could from you in a very gentle way to try and help you out, to try and understand.
And he was also incredibly humble, Deneuveau says. Both his illustrated memoirs became bestsellers in France. But he never boasted. Illustrating his trauma was a coping mechanism, not a quest for fame.
By, you know, drawing this, telling those stories, he was able to keep death at bay at a certain distance. And that, you know, he was very confident in that little circle around him, and that everything that was dangerous was a bit outside of that circle and in his books. And, you know, that's the impression he was giving, because he was very joyful. He was a light in the chaos. And he shone a light on the darker places of post-traumatic stress disorder.
He was a sun with some cloud around him.
This is Franck Coste, another survivor of the Bataclan attacks. He tells me when he met de Wilde 8 years ago at a Life for Paris meetup, it was like kismet. They had the same taste in music, the same dark sense of humor, and they both liked to write. They were even recently working on a play together called Scar Tissue. The last time Coste and Deneuveau saw de Wilde was at a concert. It was only 4 days before he took his life.
It was a great, great time. And we share beer, a lot of beer, and we dance together.
In de Wilde's memoir, The Bite, he describes the trauma of living with the ideas of the Bataclan attacks, and later the Nice attacks, as like a snake bite, a stain that represents hate and fear, which can grow and recede depending on the moment. It's all part of a bigger message, Deneuveau says.
Remember the messages within his books that, you know, it was a struggle, but it was a struggle worth living.
It's a message that other survivors, like Coste, say they are taking to heart, especially in times like this.
It's not the time to be victim. It's time to be survivor. And we just try to survive.
We have to be like soldiers, Coste says, fighting against all these nightmares. For 8.5 years, de Wilde fought against his nightmares by drawing. It's what helped him forget the pain, he says.
If you want to forget something, you have to work on it. It helps you to take distance. I think that drawing helped me. It's the only way to me explain the thing you are afraid of if you want to forget it.
De Wilde leaves behind his wife and 3 children. It's expected his loved ones will play a song from the last concert he attended several days before his death. It's a song about grief, Making a Cross, by Alan Johannes. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Paris.
I'm making a cross.
The National Suicide and Crisis Prevention Lifeline is available by text at 988. It is really hot in Mexico right now. At least 10 Mexican cities have clocked record temperatures in recent weeks. It's causing blackouts across the country, and school was canceled in the central state of San Luis Potosi last Thursday. It was 122 degrees. In the capital, Mexico City, thermometers peaked at 94 degrees. Might not sound too terribly hot, but it's unusual for a city 1.5 miles above sea level. Across Mexico, at least 26 people have died of heat stroke in recent weeks, and animals are feeling it too. Howler monkeys are native to parts of Mexico, especially the Gulf state of Tabasco. Lorena Vivas told CNN that she and her neighbors heard monkeys howling louder than usual. When they followed the sound, they came across dozens of the animals sprawled out on the ground. One monkey held my hand and shed a tear, she said. They were crying for help. The neighbors rushed to give monkeys water to drink, but for many of them, it was too late. At least 83 howler monkeys were found dead in the area. Some were rescued by residents or were taken to a local vet who struggled to save them.
Los ejemplares venían muy deshidratados, venían en estado de inconsciencia.
Brenda Mendez said the monkeys were dehydrated, some were unconscious or had a high fever. The current heat wave comes in the midst of a severe drought, also affecting much of the country. Lakes and reservoirs are drying up, with water supplies running low. Access to clean water is a key issue in the upcoming general election in Mexico. That is scheduled for June 2nd. Coming up, using the law of the sea to fight climate change. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. An international tribunal yesterday ruled that countries must prevent greenhouse gases from harming the world's oceans. The International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea ruled that carbon emissions are a form of marine pollution and spelled out legal obligations for governments to follow. The request for an advisory opinion was made by a group of small island nations that are already affected by rising seas. Margareta Vavarinka Singh was legal counsel for that group. She explained to us the connection that the panel made between greenhouse gases and the marine environment.
The tribunal indicated very clearly that anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions constitute pollution within the meaning of the conventional law of the sea. That's a very significant finding because it means that there's a whole range of obligations of states that then apply to their activities that contribute to climate change.
Yeah, I want to get to that. I understand this is an advisory opinion, which is not legally binding per se. What does it actually compel industrialized nations to do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that they're not already obligated to do, for example, under the Paris Climate Agreement?
Yeah, so the reason why small island states actually approached this tribunal and requested this advice is that the Paris Agreement is relatively thin when it comes to obligations. And so we see that the climate plans that have been submitted really fall short in terms of what is needed to prevent catastrophe. And so the tribunal was asked to look at obligations that exist not only in the Paris Agreement, but also under other treaties and mainly under the law of the sea. And the tribunal stated that the obligations that exist under the law of the sea are separate from the obligations under the Paris Agreement, and they go further in a way. What is very important is that these obligations are informed by the best available science. We know that if we exceed 1.5 degrees of warming, the implications will be truly catastrophic, and already climate change has caused significant harm to the climate system. And so that means that the risks are high and also the foreseeability is high. And therefore, the obligations of due diligence, in the words of the tribunal, that exist on states are stringent.
Let's talk about the actual impact this is going to have on the ground. Small island nations are pursuing this strategy of looking to international courts in order to give them more tools to help limit greenhouse gas emissions coming from other countries. But what would that look like? What form would that take here? How much teeth does this opinion actually have?
What the tribunal has clarified are obligations that are very much binding. And so if states don't do what the tribunal has said needs to be done, they are violating their international obligations and they can be held to account. And that can be done through various mechanisms or even through diplomatic channels. But hopefully that won't be necessary because hopefully states, by having received this very clear signal from the tribunal, will be looking again at their level of ambition, their climate plans, and will make sure that what they are doing and what they're pledging to do is compatible with what we now fully understand is required under international law.
The U.S. is the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, the largest historic emitter, and it is not a signatory to the Law of the Seas Treaty. So will this ruling have any impact on U.S. actions?
So, formally speaking, not immediately, but it's widely understood that the conventional law of the sea reflects what we know as customary international law. That is, you can say, the unwritten rules of international law that bind each and every state irrespective of the treaties that they have ratified. And the United States itself recognizes UNCLOS as reflecting largely customary international law. So I wouldn't expect the United States to argue that it is in no way bound by the obligations that are set out in this opinion. And then when it comes to enforcement of obligations, again, it is hoped that this signal will be taken to heart and it will lead to a revision of climate plans and an increase in ambition, including on the part of the United States.
Has there been any response so far from industrialized countries?
I think most states are still processing the opinion and trying to understand what exactly it means for them. But I do expect positive responses because most industrialized states have participated in the proceedings. So they recognize the importance of these proceedings and have made arguments that are generally constructive. So I think many states will want to be seen as taking this opinion seriously and seriously trying to comply with what has been spelled out in it.
Margarete Weverinka-Singh is a professor of law at the University of Amsterdam. She was helping us understand the impact of a new ruling by the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea that classifies greenhouse gases as a form of marine pollution. In Afghanistan, the Islamic State extremist group has claimed responsibility for an attack that killed three Spanish tourists last week. They were shot while traveling in Afghanistan's central Bamiyan province. The Afghan Taliban took over the country in 2021 and have pledged to restore security. They're also encouraging tourists to come. And despite the well-founded concerns, some are.
I'm Laura Council. I'm from New Zealand, and I've just about to wrap up my tour with Safariat Travel.
Safariat Travel is a small operation run out of Britain that offers tours to historic parts of Afghanistan. In this promotional video, Council says her family begged her not to go for safety reasons.
After a couple of days of being here, a lot of that went out the window when I realized, gosh, it feels safe, it feels calm. Interactions with the Taliban have been nothing but respectful, polite and friendly. Lots more interactions with people than I think I expected to have, especially as a woman.
There's a huge boom in the Afghan tourism industry in the last, couple of years.
Joe Sheffer runs Safariat Travel. We reached him in Bamiyan, Afghanistan. He is a former journalist who spent a decade in the country and then decided he wanted to help Afghans looking for work opportunities. When Sheffer says there's been a huge boom in tourism, that is relative.
This year, the Taliban say that there's 7 or maybe 10,000 foreign tourists. Now, those figures might not be correct, but you can be sure that there are considerably more foreign tourists than there probably ever has been since the 1960s, the 1970s, the hippie trail when Afghanistan was a key part of that route.
The hippie trail took travelers overland between Europe and Asia. It, of course, was popular before the Taliban or the Islamic State came along. The U.S. State Department advises against traveling to Afghanistan these days due to terrorism, risk of wrongful detention, kidnapping and crime. Jack Morris is a manager with Oddly Travel, an adventure tour company based in the UK and Boston. It has sent scouts to 93 countries looking for possible sites to visit, but not to Afghanistan.
It's not that the country itself doesn't offer products that we'd be happy to sell. It's that we don't have that first-hand experience. We don't have those partners and those relationships. There's so much to see out there that we don't have in our portfolio.
Morris says his company sticks to the places that the State Department says are okay for U.S. tourists. So a place like Afghanistan would be simply out of bounds. More global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. Stay with us. You are listening to The World. When this famous translator works, he sees his job as finessing German text into English.
I think it's like building up a road is my metaphor for it. You know, the thing gets better made and the camber is improved and the rain bounces off it and the road just gets better and better.
The art of translation recognized with a major award. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Aral Sea is on the border between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. At one time, it was the fourth largest lake on the planet. But in the 1970s, that lake started to lose water. And by the mid-1980s, it had shrunk down to about a tenth of its original size. Most of that shrinkage happened during the Soviet era, when authorities diverted the lake's main tributaries for agriculture projects. In more recent years, a major engineering project has partially restored the Aral Sea. And it could be a model for other communities to replicate as climate change threatens lakes worldwide. As part of our ongoing effort to highlight solutions relevant in our warming world, reporter Levi Bridges takes us to western Kazakhstan.
What used to be a harbor in the former Kazakh port town of Aral is currently a beige desert with spindly bushes. Camels often roam here. You can't see a lake, just a couple big puddles. 67-year-old Akshabak Batimova grew up nearby. She points to old buildings that used to be fish processing plants beside rusty cranes that once hauled cargo off of ships. She says kids used to play here by fishing boats, unloading their catch. The Aral Sea was a freshwater lake, but it turned salty when the water got lower. Fish died off, and people like Batimova's family lost their jobs. Then came the dust storms that started blowing up from the lake bed. Batimova says all this dust made people sick. I've gotten bronchitis and my lungs bother me, she says. The dust continues to be a problem to this day. It contains pesticides that washed in from farmland upstream. Researchers have found high rates of cancer here. Sarah Cameron is a history professor at the University of Maryland who's writing a book about the lake. She says that at the height of the disaster in the Soviet era, people in communities throughout the region felt the effects.
I can see this in archival documents where people complain about the climate changing, you know, less water, less rainfall, the climate becoming more severe, more continental, so hotter summers, more severe winters.
But after the Soviet Union fell, Kazakhstan launched an ambitious plan to save the Aral Sea. At the heart of the project is a dam built in the early 2000s. I drive for hours through the desert to get to the dam.
It's much smaller than I thought.
The purpose of this dam is to keep most of the water consolidated in one part of the lake. So even though most areas where the lake receded are still bone dry, on the dam's northern side, where most people live, water laps against concrete. It's filled enough that the water here turned fresh again. The fishing industry rebounded, and the dust storms, while still a problem, have become more tolerable. What Kazakhstan did could be replicated elsewhere. Officials thousands of miles away in Utah recently tried something similar when the Great Salt Lake dropped dangerously low. They filled a breach in a railroad causeway that divides the lake, so they could separate the lake in two sections to better manage salinity levels. Bonnie Baxter is director of the Great Salt Lake Institute.
If we can't get more water to the lake, sacrificing part of the lake is one of the proposals on the table. That's frankly very inexpensive. I mean, it's a backhoe and some rocks to seal off this hole in the causeway. It's super cheap engineering.
The solution is not without challenges, though, in Kazakhstan or beyond. The Aral Sea has tributaries that flow through six different countries. Afghanistan is building a canal that will eventually divert nearly a quarter of one of the Aral Sea's main tributaries. Last year, Kazakhstan received so little water that even the dammed-off part of the Aral Sea is getting low. The water's turning salty again, and fish are having trouble spawning. At a long, sandy beach, you can see how a success story is potentially turning into a new disaster. Kazakh fishermen now have to push their boats through the muck about a quarter mile before it's deep enough to fire up the engine. Local fisherman Darhan Yembergenov says lots of fishermen are giving up and moving elsewhere.
Because I was born here, my home is here.
But he says, I'm not moving. This is my home, the place I was born. And where are we supposed to move anyway? Kazakh researchers believe they can still turn the situation around by better managing the country's water. How they respond to these struggles could prove as instructive elsewhere as what they've already accomplished. For communities to thrive here, scientist Zauhan Irmahanov says radical adaptation might be necessary. Irmahanov says we might need to introduce saltwater fish if we can't stop the lake from turning salty. In a world with less water, creating an ocean environment here might be the only way to save the local economy. Back in Aral, there's a celebration in the town square. People are dancing before a woman singing on a small stage. This community feels resilient. Kazakhs saved the Aral Sea once before. Now, they believe they can do it again. For The World, Levi Bridges, Aral, Kazakhstan.
The International Booker Prize was announced last night. It's an annual honor in literary fiction for works that are translated into English and published in the UK or Ireland. Jenny Erpenbeck is the first German writer to win the Booker for her novel Kairos. The book is about a doomed love affair that takes place in the years leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Erpenbeck shares the honor and the prize money with the book's translator, Michael Hoffman. Hoffman has been described as arguably the world's most influential translator of German into English. We reached him in London today, and I asked him to describe his process of translation.
I think translation is often a matter of really tiny things, just to unsettle the reader or relax him or accelerate him. That's really it. It doesn't seem like a great mystery, except I think it's a matter maybe of great finesse or maybe of my own sort of technique of applying many, many coats. You know, so I will go through a book many, many times. I get it into some kind of English, and then I make it better. And the first stage is always sort of torment. I think it's like building up a road is my metaphor for it. And then, you know, the thing gets better made and the camber is improved and the rain bounces off it and the road just gets better and better. It's an incremental activity. And a lot of the time I'm guided by the book, but I'm also guided by English and what English in my sense of it likes and wants. I mean, how you know, you don't want to kind of rough up English too much.
Yeah, let's talk about the novel in question here. This novel, Kairos, is about a tortured love affair in the waning days of East Germany. Does that place and that time period have any resonance for you?
It does. I mean, East Germany is a place where I had relatives. I mean, I visited my uncle and my grandmother when I was a sort of started translating, being a kind of professional. I translated a couple of Brecht plays, and so I had to go to Oranienburg in East Berlin and by hand copy out pages from the photocopy, because they wouldn't let you see anything printed, and they were very wary of photocopiers. And so I had dealings in East Germany. I had readings in East Berlin at about the same time. It's always sort of darker. You notice there was less light. There were no advertisements. You didn't see the police. The traffic was slower. It just felt like an oddly different kind of muted world. But then when you're among people who trusted each other, you had great warmth and you had very, very sort of quick, very quick conversation. People kind of praised each other very quickly and trusted each other very quickly.
Interesting. More topical, I guess, question here. The digital age has given us so many new tools to understand information. There's Google Translate to help us read things written in languages that we don't speak. We're also seeing the rise of artificial intelligence, which I can only imagine is a topic of conversation in your field. What do you make of AI and artificial intelligence translation, and what role that human translators play now and will play going forward?
I'm a sort of, I'm agnostic about this, I must say. I have no great experience of these things. I have no great interest in them either. I'm sure they're all being steadily improved. I think writers still do things in books that no machine would do. And I think translators do things in books that no machine would do either. And I'm probably old enough to feel pretty relaxed about it all in my 60s. I think if I was 30 or so, I might feel differently about it. I might feel more positive about it. I might feel this was a friendly thing come along to make my life easier. I might feel it was the devil's own tool come to take away my labor. I don't really like the idea of people being eased out of occupations by machines because, you know, we are on the planet and I don't know, you know, if we're not allowed to work, I don't know what role there is for us. I suppose on a day like this, I feel slightly immune from machine danger.
Fair enough.
Briefly. But, otherwise, I know they're gnawing at us.
And why do you see the translation of literary works as so important, bringing this work that was written in German to, you know, a much wider and a very different audience?
Well, it's really important to get out of your skin and imagine being somebody else, imagine living under a different set of conditions. One's own circumstances fill one's own head, and they shouldn't. And reading can be a distraction or a liberation or a form of warning. It's for all of these that one reads. And for the translator, it's almost sort of artisanal work. It's like tooling leather or making veneers for furniture. It's something sort of, in a sense, very, very superficial and very painstaking, but with a, you know, absurdly high degree of finish.
You're, as I've said, considered one of the foremost translators of German into English. You also write and have won awards for your own poetry, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
So I'm wondering if you can talk to me about the difference you feel between writing your own work and translating somebody else's. Is one easier? Is one more challenging? Is one more fun?
I think nothing is more fun than writing a poem, but I, sadly for myself, I'm not a poet who writes poems at will and or indeed very often. I'm German, so it matters to me to be productive, to produce, to create. And translation seemed a way of getting more words out of me than I would necessarily produce on my own.
Michael Hoffman is the translator of Jenny Erpenbeck's novel Kairos, this year's winner of the International Booker Prize. He also teaches at the University of Florida. He spoke with us today from London. You can hear lots of different kinds of music in Turkey, but one genre is notably absent from most live music venues, songs sung in Kurdish. As the world's Duri Buskerin first reported last September from Istanbul, one singer has made it her life's work to document Kurdish folk songs before they disappear.
In this video, a goat herder sits in his yard next to an old stone house, singing against a bright blue sky. It's an old song, and one that's specific to Argovan, a region that's famous for folk songs that are sung in Turkish. But this one isn't widely known because it's sung in Kurdish. Musician Ayfer Duzdash made these recordings to document Kurdish folk songs still remembered by village elders. Few have been transcribed and preserved. People would ask me, why are you recording these songs? They'll be useless, Duzdash says. They thought the songs were insignificant. But she disagrees. Back in Istanbul, Duzdash has taken the melodies and the lyrics and transformed them into full ensemble performances, like this one, a love song called Limin. Thirteen songs are compiled in Duzdash's latest album, Songs of Argovan. Duzdash started collecting folk songs back in 1997, a ceasefire between the Turkish government and Kurdish militants, known as the PKK, had recently broken down, and the Turkish military pushed into northern Iraq to pursue them. Kurdish civilians in Turkey, like Duzdash, often had to hide their identity to avoid harassment and discrimination. At school, her teachers forbade her from speaking Kurdish at all. The teacher assigned a few students from the class to watch out for other students who were speaking Kurdish and report it to the teacher, Duzdash says. Turkey's policy to keep Kurdish instruction out of schools wasn't relaxed until 2012. Duzdash says it separated a whole generation from their mother tongue, and she realized that even at home, her family was starting to assimilate too. We actually started speaking Turkish inside the house, Duzdash says. Even if my mom or dad spoke Kurdish, we'd reply in Turkish on instinct. That went on, she says, until she decided to start making Kurdish music. Armed with an old handheld tape recorder, she traveled to villages in the Kurdish region and asked people to sing. These are the Kochgiri laments, a type of improvisation sung by Kurdish Alevis to mourn the loss of a loved one. Her mother used to sing these laments too. It can be sung at the cemetery for a funeral, but I remember her singing them when she was alone in the house, Duzdash says. In some communities, the laments can be sung to an object, like a shirt or a headscarf, that belonged to someone who has passed. Through these songs, Duzdash found herself reconnecting with her language and her culture, like when she visited a village in early March and got snowed in. You couldn't go anywhere. There was too much snow on the roads, Duzdash says. We were all gathered in front of the heater, singing these songs. It's something I always carry in my memory, she says. The Turkish military is still actively fighting the PKK and its allies in northern Iraq and parts of Syria. This spring, as Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ran his re-election campaign, he regularly made false claims that his opponents supported Kurdish militants. And these tensions trickle down into everyday life. Duzdash struggles to find venues that will let her perform Kurdish music in Turkey, so she often holds concerts abroad. But she says her most hopeful moments are when she sees both Turkish and Kurdish listeners in the audience, people from the city and people from the villages, connecting over some of the country's oldest melodies. It's the reason for my existence, she says. For the world, I'm Derry Buskerin in Istanbul.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Standing up for what you believe can mean facing opposition. The recent campus demonstrations are just one example of that. Sometimes protests are well planned out ahead of time. Others take off spontaneously. This was the case with Antonio Hasha, who found himself at the center of a media frenzy in Brazil after a split-second decision to take a stand. He recounts that moment on Stories from the Stage, a storytelling project of World TV.
It was 1987, and I was performing as a mime at the first Latin American Festival of Arts and Culture. This festival was taking place at a university in the capital city of Brazil, Brasilia. Brazil was 2 years out of a 20-year dictatorship. And we had gone to this festival to celebrate freedom and the end of oppression through the arts. You heard me right. I was performing as a mime. I had fallen in love with the art of making the invisible visible through movement and gesture. At the end of my impromptu sets, two friends of mine approached me, said, "Come with us, come with us. There's a protest going on in one of the lecture halls." So still dressed in my mime, attire, you know, I kind of jogged along through the hallways and we got to this amphitheater. The door that we entered was way up in the back of the lecture hall. And there was a mob of about 400 people going, "Go home, go home." It was filled with energy, that room. And as I looked down towards the table, way at the bottom, there was an elderly man sitting there facing the mob. There was an assistant behind him. Between this gentleman and the mob was the national media. The likes of the New York Times and Boston Globe of Brazil were there registering everything. And I soon learned what was going on. This elderly man in his 70s was a professor from Chile. and he had been handpicked by the dictator in Chile, Augusto Pinochet, to go to our festival and give a lecture on the life of Pablo Neruda. Pablo Neruda was a poet from Chile, a Nobel Prize laureate, a man who stood for freedom and against oppression. And here is a man handpicked by the military regime of Chile to come to this art festival and lecture about the life of this man. Of course they wanted him to go home. And I'm there just taking it all in, and I felt compelled to do something about it. You know, I had done some political street theater, and I had just started doing mime. I'm like, I can do something for peace and freedom here. I can add on to this. So I start to go down towards a man who was holding a mic. I thought, you know, I think he's the moderator. And I said, I'd like to do something for freedom here. And he looks me up and down, you know, my 30-pound lighter self, big afro. I was still doing the white face for mime at the time. And he kind of smiles and turns to the mob and says, he'd like to do something for peace and freedom. And they look at me and they size me up and they start to chant, on the table, on the table, on the table. I'm like, say what? They wanted me to perform on the table that the man is sitting at. If I get on that table, I'm going to get arrested. If I leave the room, I'm going to be framed as a coward. I have to do something right here. But they wouldn't let me. I looked at the professor, and the professor was straight-faced. He was not saying yes. He was not saying no. His assistant was his bodyguard, and he was tense, looking at me and looking at the professor. The cultural attaché from the embassy of Chile was there. And the students, on the table! And all of a sudden, my heart was beating here. My legs had turning like overcooked pasta. And I'm like, what do I do about this? And the whole room was like, on the table. And all of a sudden, my legs began moving so fast. My legs started moving so fast and so fast. And when they stopped and I looked down, there was a table under my feet. I was still not arrested. That's a good thing. So I better do whatever. I had no idea what I was going to do. It was going to be an impromptu performance for peace. But all of a sudden, I got it. I got the whole piece. I reached down and I picked up a military-grade rifle, a mimed one. This is a story about a mime performance, right? And I put it on my shoulder and I marched like a soldier across the table to the center of it where the professor was sitting. And then I started to scan the rifle towards the crowd. The room felt silent. And then I let out a scream that filled the whole campus. It was a primal scream. And as I was doing that, the rifle was turning into a small box. Only computer CGI and a mime can pull that off. And I opened the box ever so gently, and a bird flew out. I jumped off the table and I left. Wow. The next day, I was on all the newspapers, from the hinterlands of the Amazon to the coast. Mime keeps professor from Chile from lecturing. Mime performs for peace and against oppression. I'm like, I'm a 22-year-old trying to just do some impromptu performances, and now I'm going to get arrested. They're going to have my name. They're going to come after me. I'm going to disappear. My friend stood by me, and nothing came of it. But a lot came of it. The next year, I would land a scholarship and go to Maine to study with Tony Montanaro. The dictatorship in Chile ended in 1990. By the time of his death, dictator Augusto Pinochet had some 300 cases against him for human rights violation. As Pablo Neruda said, and I quote, "You may cut all the flowers, but you can't keep spring from coming." Thank you.
That was Antonio Hasha sharing his experience on Stories from the Stage from our GBH partners at World TV. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great night, and we will see you tomorrow.
Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.